Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. As strong supporters of the American Kennel Club, we talk about everything from conformation to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between. Your passion is our purpose. Tremendous thanks to our sponsor, Royal Canin. Every day, more top breeders are choosing Royal Canin. Join the winning team. Okay, crew, before we get into today's show, I am super excited to tell you about something new here at Pure Dog Talk. We know breeders are the lifeblood of our sport. We celebrate and honor our master breeders. So we're bringing you Breeders' Voice. Breeders' Voice sits down with top breeders, sharing their secrets, how they got where they are, the joys, and maybe even the heartbreaks. If you haven't had a chance, click the Don't Miss an Episode button so you'll get these in-depth articles delivered free along with your podcast. Sign up on our Facebook page or at puredogtalk.com. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I'm your host, Laura Reeves, and I have a very special guest today. Anna Quigley is someone who is very, very well known in the Northwest. I can remember seeing her with her amazing Commodore when I was just a little kid. So, Anna, thank you so much for joining us, and I'm excited to talk to you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah. So give us, we call it the 411. Give us your background. What got you started in purebred dogs and why Commodore and all that kind of great stuff?
Well, actually, I started in rough collies and I had a collie and I came up to Patricia Turner's place to breed it and became acquainted. And I actually came up to take care of their dogs when I was 19 years old, when her and her family went down to Los Angeles to get the first Commodore. And so Bobo came into our life in 1973.
That's pretty incredible. And so what made you want to go from the collies to the Commodore? I mean, it's not like you were downsizing your grooming.
Well, in a way we were, because with collies you dealt with the shedding and all that. But the Commodores quickly, you know, we had the first one, and she was kind of a character, and we learned, I think Pat Hastings says, it's very unusual to not ruin your first of anything, any breed. And we certainly proved that point with our very first Commodore, because she was as spoiled as can be, and they told us that you could never keep them in a crate. Well, guess what? We could never keep her in a crate. And so we just got more interested, and we got our second Commodore from Ken O'Brien in California, who now is a show photographer, and he had a heart problem, but we didn't have him very long. He was 2.5 when we got him, and we lost him to a heart problem within a year. Then we, in the meantime, had purchased a dog, a female from Salt Lake, and she was not the best, but she had some very good basic things that the breed needed, which was full dentation, good eye color, and several other things, but she ended up becoming our foundation bitch. And we bought our foundation male from Dottie Collier in 1976, and that's kind of where it got started. And then, you know, we had a litter from the two of them, went back east, I think it was in 1979, to show them and met Dottie the first time and finished one of their get and got two majors on the female that we took back. And we had bought Tiger from her, and you know, you may have seen him or may not have, but he was our foundation male. So that's kind of where it all got started, and the breed was very good to us, and there was room for people in the breed, so we managed to become very successful and owe the breed a lot.
Well, and you definitely have been very, very successful. So talk to me about Commodore numbers, right? Like what they were in the 70s, what they are today, in terms of rare breeds, in terms of how many of them are there worldwide. I mean, this is a very powerful dog. It's a big dog. You have the big corded coat. You know, this isn't something that John Q. Public necessarily has in his home.
Yeah, I don't know numbers right now, but my guess is that in there's probably less than there was when we got started. Mainly, people do not have the patience for the court if they're showing them. And there's very few people that are showing them right now. There were several big-time people that were in it in the 90s and the 80s that, you know, we used to have quite a concentration in California, quite a concentration in the Northeast. And I know that Nancy leaves and is not as active as she used to be. John Landis doesn't even own one now. Dottie stopped a long, long time ago owning the Brie. So, you know, my guess is there's just very, very few being shown at this point. As far as numbers, I think they've probably maintained about the same the whole time I've been in the breed. So it's not a breed that will ever become popular because of the coat. So, and that's a good thing. But it is tough because whereas for a while the gene pool was getting larger, now there's fewer dogs and you have less opportunity to see the dogs that are out there. So it's kind of tough breeding a litter of Commodores and finding a male that you can actually have access to. So, you know, at one point there was like 10,000, we figured, in the world.
Wow. Okay. I mean, it's low numbers, but it's not otter hounds where they have 800.
No.
Right.
No. They were pretty well extinct after World War II, and there was very few breedable dogs left after World War II.
Okay. So you've built back those numbers from... A lot of breeds had that same,
yeah.
Clumber Spaniels, you know, had that same kind of thing. So you're working with a pretty small gene pool, and have you, clearly if you've built it back up to those kind of numbers, you've had some success in creating sustainable genetics, sustainable breeding programs.
Well, when we first joined the Commodore Club of America, one of the requirements is that you could not breed any closer than three generations back. And that was to help expand the lines and create different lines.
Right. And that was a requirement from the Commodore Club specifically.
Yep.
That's pretty impressive that they were that focused on it even at that point in time. I think that's pretty incredible. So talk to us a little bit. Most of our listeners are going to understand Commodore are large flock guardian dogs. They have the cords. And the corded coat is part of protecting them to do their job, correct?
Yes, correct. And from the elements.
Right. So talk to us about maintaining that coat for a show ring versus having one of these dogs either working as a livestock guardian or in your home as a companion.
Well, I think that entirely depends on the part of the country you live in. Us living in Western Washington, we get rain. So we have a lot of gravel area for the dogs, which really helps maintain the coat. As a young dog, our dogs have a lot of freedom because we found out early on, if they don't build up that correct muscle tone and bone structure by having exercise, the coat won't make a bit of a difference. So we really are pretty scrappy when they're young. If we finish them and when we used to special dogs, their life became a lot more limited. We kept different parts of the coat tied up. So we didn't bathe them the night before the show, but we did keep them tied up so they'd stay relatively clean. On blacktop, it wasn't uncommon to see me walk around hotel parking lots with tube socks on their feet.
I remember it well.
Yeah. Because, you know, trying to bathe these dogs and get those cords, you know, they're dense and it takes a long time to get them dry. Now, when Pat's husband was alive, I would get up early in the morning and bathe them and have the initial drying done by replacing towels underneath them. And her husband would finish the drying, which really made life a lot easier, and it made it easier on the dogs. But you can figure on a fully coated Commodore anywhere from 7 to 10 hours to get them dry.
Yeah. There's no forced drying here. This is all basically like squeegeeing these hairs, right?
Yeah. Well, you bring them out when you first get them done bathing, and then you put the blowers on them, and you want that air to circulate, the warm air. You know, you don't have hot air, but you do have warm air, and you want that air to circulate around them. And if it was a Saturday and Sunday show, we always bathed on Thursday so that then they had Friday, imagine this, to rest up, get back on their water, and rest up from the stress of the bath. And I really think that was part of our success is because the dog went to the show and they were pretty well rested up after the grooming. But if they're working dogs, normally, you know, you'll find your big sheep herds in a drier, hotter climate or a drier, colder climate. It normally isn't the wet climate. So the coat maintains pretty well. You're going to have a lot of debris on the outer edges of the coat. Will collect a lot of sticks and whatever debris is in the field. But at the base of the cord, it'll stay just nice and clean and white. But they'll never be white, white like the dogs that go to the shows, because they can't be. And you will not see a working dog at a show, because their value is in the field.
And they are still used as flock guardians today, correct, Anna?
Yeah, the temperament is pretty much the same as it was when they first came into the country. And then when they started to get a foothold in the ring, which was in the 70s, they were actually recognized in 1932.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, but they just never took off.
Mm-hmm. So do you see them used in this country as flock guardians?
Yeah, not so much, but we get a lot of inquiries. I will send them on to people that have more than I do. Not that I object to people selling them for working dogs, but I don't have the knowledge to back up their needs. In the United States, it appears to me that they live a lonelier life than they do in Hungary and in Europe. In Europe, they have herdsmen that live right with them. And in this country, they want to put them out in the field and just leave them there and let them live with the sheep. And they do love their owners. They absolutely are devoted to their owners. So just because I'm older and I've been at this a long time, if somebody writes us and wants a working dog, we just send them someplace else. Because we can. I figure at my age, I can do that.
So talk to me a little bit about the parent club having a limited, specific way of handling breedings. So talk to me a little bit about some of your successful pedigrees and how you've been able to build a family of dogs working with basically some sort of one arm tied behind your back.
So that's exactly right. Well, when we bought Tiger from Dottie, he was 10 months old and he was out of a outside female and it was her puppy back. So he was a little bit different pedigree than the rest of her D litters, a lot of the Commodore breeders name them by alphabet. So what we gained by that is often when he was used for stud, instead of taking a stud service, if the pedigree was right on the female, we would take a puppy back.
Oh, sure. Nice. And then you could breed that back into what you already were working with.
And then there's a few people like Dahoo, the one that we did so well with. We had a real strong puppy back from a male we placed with John Landis. And structurally, she wasn't the brightest Commodore in the world, but she had structure galore. And we seen a dog up in Canada at a national in Pennsylvania, of all things. And we went to breed to him. And my comment to Pat was, we always agreed we'd breed to the devil if it could improve our line. So we bred to him, and that gave us Dahoo. So not only did he do well in the ring, he produced very nicely. And we've been using his frozen semen lately on some of our females.
Didn't you just have a litter from him not maybe a year or so ago?
Yeah, we do. And we have one male puppy from that. And he's a pretty nice boy.
So now Dahoo, remind everybody, I certainly remember him, but remind everybody about his sort of success. Because he really, I think in a lot of ways, put Commodore in the public eye more than anything else.
He was born after I had retired Tiger. And we did not want to keep another male right then. And we had sold him. And when he was 2 and a half, he lived actually down there towards where you live, in Southern Oregon. We went down to see him, and he was tied to a tree in the backyard and very much willing to bite somebody, and the family really didn't like him. So he came back, and he just easily worked his way into our hearts, and he was totally reliable with everybody in the family, but he knew how to bite, which, of course, you don't want a dog to figure out. But I went to a lot of work to open up my heart and my mind to suggestions on how to get this stopped, and we did. And there was things we would change about him. His muzzle was mostly the only thing that we would change. But other than that, he was a pretty darn good Commodore. And he just took off and won 3 nationals and took him back to the garden. And he won the group there, which was just over the top happy for that. And he just was a really solid all-around dog, and he also produced. He actually produced one of the dogs that we always felt was our very best dog, which was his son Dozer. But his success came with a lot of work and a lot of commitment to the breed and to him.
And I think it's a pretty amazing story and a testament both to your commitment to him and the breed, but also to the breed's resiliency. I think that's very impressive.
Yeah, for 2 years after I got him back, if I raised my hand to pull my hair back, he'd hit the ground. He'd been hit in the head so much. But he figured it out. I mean, he figured out that we were committed to him, and he had to learn that we would keep him safe. And once he knew we would keep him safe, then that night at Westminster, you know, I knew that Irene Bevan liked him because she'd seen him in Vancouver, but this was New York, and you never knew really which dog who, which I don't think you ever can predict what Commodore ever is going to show up. But finally, going to be fine tonight, and he was. And he was a fun-loving dog, and we drove from here up to Jane Anderson's handling class. She always tried to convince me when he'd do the down and back, he would have a tendency to jump straight up in the air. And she said, just trust him to come down and be right. Well, that night he jumped straight up in the air, and I trusted him, and he came down in his perfect gait. And the nice thing about that dog, he lived to be 14 and a half. So he was the size that enabled him to live, whereas his son, who was a beautiful typey dog that we bred to a Hungarian import, and Cruz was 145 pounds as compared to Dahu at 108. But Cruz at 7 had arthritis so bad that he barely could handle the bath and then go to the show. He would just shake, his back legs would shake. And Cruz was gone by 10. So if I had to choose, I think that 110-pound type Commodore could do the job. If he was out in the field doing the job, he could have done that job till he was 13 easy. And that's been my favorite size area because they just are long-lived. And when we look at our Commodores, we always think to ourselves, is this a dog that would give a farmer who puts 2 to 3 years into trusting a dog another 10-year service of work? And that's what we set our goal as. They don't have to be giants when they're coming from here.
Well, and I think that you make such a valid point. Bigger is not necessarily better, even in our large breeds. And I think sometimes we lose sight of that.
Yeah, but unfortunately, our standard says bigger the better, all other things considered. So you definitely don't want midgets. But in the 70s and 80s, our average Commodore was 26, 27. My favorite size Commodore is 27, 27 and a half. That seems like a good size that will do the job for quite a while.
Talk to us about the heads. You talked about Dahu had just a little bit short in the muzzle. So it's been too long since I read the standard, but give our listeners the description of the head that your standard puts out there, because these are dogs, as flock guardians, they have to be able to stand up to the large predators, right? So that head and jaw is really, really important.
What you want is about 60-40, 60% of the back skull and 40% of the muzzle. You want a really good truncated muzzle. Where I would have changed Dahu, not his width of muzzle, he had a full muzzle, but I'd like him to have more under jaw to make it more truncated. You want a nice full head. You need to convince the membership to vote and add 2 inches to the recommended size of our standard. And that made a taller, leaner dog. Well, when you think about a wolf or a coyote coming on this dog, you don't want a dog to easily get their muzzle over. So along with the head, you full head. We don't have as many good heads right now in our breed as we did in the 70s. We kind of lost them a little bit. But you want that fullness of body so that that dog, you don't want a St. Bernard type body, but you want a full body so that that coyote just can't grab him and take him down. But there was a that she killed 5 for. That's just a commentary on the fact that this dog that it has to be able to outmaneuver, still be able to bite and penetrate their back and take him.
So, Anna, I think the other thing that is always been sort of a wonderful testament to your involvement with the sport and with your breed, this was a family affair, if you will. And I loved always seeing the kids at the shows and all of that. So if you could offer our listeners kind of some advice or encouragement or thoughts about going forward in this sport and what makes it great and what they can do to help make it great.
Our Timberland Dog Club just recently had a family that joined, and one of the questions put to the club is, what can junior membership do for junior members? And my comment to the board and to the club, the door's open. This is an area that I think all clubs and all breeders need to really consider, because it's a sport that's not bringing in families, because I don't think it has anything to do with the sport itself as much as both parents are working. They don't have the time. So we really need to be creative on how we can help these young people, to encourage them to continue to come to the show. And they won't stay active unless the parents are involved, of course. And so Nick did not stay involved. It's unfortunate he didn't, because he can really show a dog. But he works construction, and sometimes I can talk him into it if I call him and need him to help me at a show. You know, I don't show so much, so he'll come, but he doesn't have the time. But I think it's getting more and more difficult for families to get involved. I remember when I was showing the Poolie, and there were several new herding breeds led into the herding group, and it just means that what we need to do is take the time to help them to know when to do things when they're in the group. Help them out. Be a friendly face. Because it's a sport that's going to get harder and harder to make it. And without young people coming in, it won't make it. It just won't make it. You know, I mean, it'll make it to some extent, but not at the level that you and I came into this sport.
Right. And I think your discussion of things that clubs can do to encourage younger members. And I was telling this to somebody else, I think it's really, really interesting to me. A great deal of the people who listen to this podcast, for example, and people who are coming in as new exhibitors, the trend appears to be, to me, and I'm going to be talking to AKC soon, and maybe they'll have some more numbers on this, but we're seeing, instead of teenagers or young people as much, we're seeing middle-aged people, empty nesters, people who are maybe retired early, or they finally have the time and the resources to put towards this passion. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a fascinating trend and has some really good potential, actually, for the sport and for the clubs, because you have people with the wherewithal, with the time, with the resources, that if we are nice to them and help them, that they can stick around and help us build the sport.
I think one thing that I've noticed as well is that in many, many cases, because of the internet, sometimes people get information that pulls them away from people that breed with AKC and try to keep up the health standards. I've noticed that lately in Commodores, that people get information and they can really sour people. And we have to be aware of that, that our words matter. And I don't know that we can always help every bit of it, because you're always going to have that. We always have. But I think with the onset of the internet, I think sometimes misinformation and bad feelings get going quicker than it ever did in the past. I was thinking the other day about Dottie Collier and how many letters we had sent back and forth, because it was back when, you know, phone calls weren't cheap. And to meet her the first time and the impact that had, and then how it would have changed in this day and age. You meet people, you've seen them showing on pictures on the Facebook, and so much has changed. But at the same time, in my opinion, it's made the sport more vulnerable, because people can judge, and they do. So I think we just all have to be very much aware of what we're saying and how we're saying it.
I think that is absolutely invaluable advice, and I really appreciate you sharing that with folks. And I know you are actively involved in your club and giving back to the sport all the time. So thank you.
That's my most activity, is to my club. Now, I don't show much, but I keep trying, and I keep stressing to folks when they want to join or they want to work the club, you know, the weekend. I say, hey, you know, when I was showing, I looked at it that if I wanted to, I could almost go to a show every weekend at somebody else's work. And I always felt like it was my obligation to give back a weekend. And Pat and I both have still stayed active. We don't go to the shows as much, although I've got two young animals I really like. You might see me back more.
Good. I'm excited. I miss seeing you.
Yeah, I miss everybody, but I don't know how I ever had time. I think one thing that really changed for us is when Pat's husband passed away, and I think not having him here, it just changed the ability to go. But I love the sport. I still keep up with the sport. I love my breed. even though I know at my age we have to keep track of how many we have, and we're kind of been running the geriatric ward, but you'll see us back. So thank you for asking me.
Thanks so much, Pat. You have a great day.
Okay, bye-bye.
Welcome, Pure Dog Talk listeners. We are here with Allison Foley from the Leading Edge Dog Show Academy. And Allison is going to talk to us today about medication for our dog's ears, her favorites, and how best to apply them, and when you might need them, and how you might know. So, welcome, Allison.
Hi, Laura. How are you today?
I am awesome. How are you today?
I'm excellent. Thank you.
Excellent. So talk to us about these little ear balls.
Yeah. So this all started with a dog that I had a problem with a few years ago. So just before we get to my aha moment, I'm going to talk to you about actual ear medication. So I think so often people kind of poo-poo the importance of having your dog's ears diagnosed properly if you think there's a problem, right? So if there is a lot of black tar coming out of your dog's ears, your dog is shaking their head excessively, and of course, the smell test. If you lift up your dog's ear leather and you smell and it knocks you out, then clearly there is a problem there. So the first mistake I think people make is they self-diagnose. You know, like last time the veterinarian gave me Sirolan for this, Sirolan will fix every single ear infection under the sun, therefore I'm going to treat this ear with Sirolan. And I'm not trying to pick on Sirolan, but, you know, Canoral, Panalog, whatever, you know, your veterinarian normally prescribes, it's not one size fits all. So really just take the time. You're going to do yourself and your dog a favor if you just get it properly diagnosed. So, you know, that's kind of my AB go-to.
Yep.
And secondly, you know, we've talked in the past about making sure that if you'd have a dog that has a lot of hair in their ears, that it is plucked to a certain extent. So you want it plucked enough that there's air circulation there. So if there's air circulation, that means that the medication can get to where it needs to go.
Yes.
So the absolute worst time to pluck your dog's ear is when it does have an ear problem, because then, A, you're going to make little tiny, you know, abrasions as you're plucking the ear, even just where the hair follicle leaves the actual ear canal. And so that's just going to make a bigger, messier infection. So if you haven't properly plucked your ear before you run into a problem, once you have a problem, is not the time to do it. So now we're going to get to the point where we have our dog, they have a problem that needs attention, you've taken it to your veterinarian, and your veterinarian has prescribed you the proper medication. So this is where my aha moment came in, and I had had a dog who had a chronic ear problem, you know, like after like 4 months, I still didn't have it cleared up. And so then I talked to a veterinarian client of mine, and I just like was saying, you know, I have full faith in my veterinarian, but why is this happening? And so again, it came to a very simple solution, but I had not done this in my 30 years professionally in dogs until about 4 years ago. So here it is. So first of all, we all know when we take medication, antibiotics, that we need to complete the full course of antibiotics for it to be effective. We might feel better after 2 days, but if we stop taking the medication, we're A, building resistance to that antibiotic, and B, we aren't really better. We're starting to feel better. We're starting to beat the infection, but we have not completely beaten it. So none of us really finish our full prescription of antibiotics. You know, we might get down to 2 days left. Sometimes, you know, there's one bottle left at the end, but that's a struggle. But we have to make sure we are very diligent when it comes to our dogs. Well, the same goes for ear medication. We can't use ear medication twice and the ear looks better and then we stop, because we're just inviting the infection to get stronger, to become resistant to that antibiotic, because typically, you know, they have some kind of antibiotic in them. And then we're just inviting the problem again. So on top of that is the problem with directions on ear medications. Now, again, I am not a veterinarian, but I am telling you my aha moment from an awesome veterinarian. And it was this. It says on the bottle or on your prescription that your dog needs 5 to 10 drops in the ear canal. Well, first of all, once you take that applicator that has typically a long, slender nozzle so you can get it into the ear canal, how do you know when you've put in 5 or 10 drops? How do you know it's not 2 or 22 drops? Basically, you can't. So then if you're dropping the drops from up where you can see how many drops are actually getting in there, then they're not getting as efficiently into the actual ear canal where they need to be. And so he told me his tip that he used for his entire clientele, which was this. Anytime he dispenses ear medication, he dispenses an empty dispensary bottle, like a little bottle that has a removable lid.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells his clients to put the entire bottle of medication into this applicator bottle. And then he gives them 10 days worth of syringes. And he simply tells them, basically, again, I'm going to use my analogy. He was more scientific. But if on a small dog, you would use half a mil, and on a big dog, you would use 1 mil, which is approximately 10 drops, half a mil, approximately 5 drops. And then once you have drawn the appropriate amount of ear medication into the syringe, you can then place that syringe and you know that you're getting the proper dosage where it needs to go. Now, this seems really simple, and I am telling you, my ears have cleaned up in the 7 to 10 day recommended period ever since I've adopted this procedure. He sends along 10 syringes, so every day I have a new syringe. I'm not putting, you know, an old, dirty, contaminated syringe in that dog's ear. And it is one of those things that has changed my ear health life with my dog.
Love it. And it's changed my life. And I think absolutely you're dead on, Allison, the getting your dog's ear properly diagnosed. I want to go back to that one because I am as guilty of it as anybody else. I had a dog this last summer, young wire hair pointer dog, that I couldn't get his ears cleaned up, and I kept using all my right stuff. And I'm like, God, I can't get this fixed. And I finally took him into the vet, like I should have done in the first place. And she says, oh, hey, look at all these foxtails down here in the bottom of his ear canal. I'm like, yeah, that's good. So yeah. I think very, very important point to make sure that if you have something going on with your dog's ears, spend the money, take it to a trained professional, have them look in there. They can diagnose a particular type of yeast. They can diagnose a particular type of bacteria. They can diagnose a foxtail or a foreign object. So dead on. Absolutely. Thank you, Allison. And listeners, don't forget, Allison has the Pure Dog Talk 25 code available. When you sign up for a Leading Edge Dog Show Academy, you get 25% discount. So buy yourself a cup of coffee on us, yeah?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Excellent. Thanks a lot, Allison.
Thanks, Laura.
The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our dog show superintendents are the hardworking people who make the dog show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the super's desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk, brought to you by the Aramedia Group, publisher of ShowSite Magazine, your home for purebred dogs.